It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, arguments in favor and against U.S. President Barack Obama's moves to normalize relations with Cuba. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. At the end of last year, President Obama ordered the restoration of full diplomatic relations with Cuba and the opening of an embassy in Havana for the first time in more than 50 years as he swept aside one of the last vestiges of the Cold War. In his State of the Union address to Congress, President Obama hailed the move and called on Congress to end the trade embargo.
You know, in Cuba, we are ending a policy that was long past its expiration date. When what you're doing doesn't work for 50 years, it's time to try something new. And our shift in Cuba policy has the potential to end a legacy of mistrust in our hemisphere. It removes a phony excuse for restrictions in Cuba, stands up for democratic values, and extends the hand of friendship to the Cuban people. And this year, Congress should begin the work of ending the embargo.
President Barack Obama outlining why he moved to restore diplomatic relations with Cuba. The surprise announcement in December 2014 came at the end of 18 months of secret talks that produced a prisoner swap negotiated with the help of none other than Pope Francis and concluded by a telephone call between Mr. Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro. A diplomatic mission headed by Assistant Secretary of State Roberta Jacobson was in the island last week holding talks on a variety of issues such as the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Cuba, migration, support for civil society, and removing Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. Recent public surveys show the majority of Americans support Mr. Obama's decision to ease the diplomatic and business embargoes on the communist nation, as do a majority of younger Cuban Americans who reside in Florida. But fully lifting the embargo will depend on Congress. And there is considerable opposition to the policy shift in the Republican-led Congress, let alone to lifting the embargo. Cuban-American members of Congress, regardless of political affiliation, are united in their opposition. Senator Marco Rubio, a Republican from the swing state of Florida, says the new Cuba policy represents a victory for oppressive governments the world over. Democratic Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey characterizes the new policy as a reward that the totalitarian Cuban regime does not deserve. But there are also reform-minded Republicans, such as Senator Jeff Flake from the state of Arizona, who has long favored the shift, saying it will be good for Cubans and good for Americans. Some key elements of the revised policy include establishing a full-fledged U.S. embassy in Havana, allowing for increased support for civil society in Cuba and the free flow of information. Travel licenses to Cuba will be available for a variety of activities, making it easier for Americans to provide business training for private Cuban businesses and small farmers. Washington will also review its 1982 designation of Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism. Well, for more on the substance and politics of normalizing relations with Cuba, we turn to two distinguished regional analysts. Mike Gonzalez is a senior fellow at the Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. That's a conservative think tank here in Washington. And Ted Piccone, he's senior fellow in foreign policy at Brookings Institution, and that's a centrist policy group based here in Washington. And Mike Gonzalez joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me here.
And Ted Piccone joins us from a studio at Brookings Institution. Ted, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Well, let me begin with you, Mike Gonzalez, here in the studio, and let's discuss the merits of this policy change. Now, I understand you are against normalizing relations with Cuba. Why?
Well, basically, we're getting in bed with a crime syndicate in Cuba. The economy, of course, is run by the military. Many of the generals who are in charge are related to Raul Castro. And beyond that, it's a police state which represses its people and has done so for 50 years. And if I may, I'll take issue with the whole issue was presented. It's not just Cuban Americans, members of Congress, who are against this quite shameful decision, actually. Many members of Congress who are not Cuban Americans are also opposed on human rights grounds and on other grounds, national security grounds. And it's also not reform-minded members of Congress who are for it. So if doing business with bad people around the world is a reform, then we should embrace North Korea, Iran, and not just Cuba.
All right. Well, let me turn out to Ted Piccone for your take on the policy shift.
I think we can all agree that Cuba has a long ways to go in terms of improving its own standards of human rights and economic freedom. The question is, how can the United States and the American people best support that kind of change? And what we've tried to do over the last 50 years is a very punitive, comprehensive embargo that the Castro regime has actually used against us. And it's isolated us from the Cuban people, from our Latin American neighbors, and in fact, the whole world has condemned this embargo. So I think President Obama was right to say, why don't we try direct engagement both with the government and with the Cuban people, and then let's help them empower the Cuban people as they try to become more independent of the Cuban state. Underway right now are some economic reforms on the island that give us that kind of opening into greater independence for the Cuban people, and the regulations that the president has now authorized foster that kind of contact.
Well, back to you, Mike Gonzalez. I think those who are for the policy shift and who are against it pretty much want the same thing. They want a more open society, a more democratic Cuba, and eventually a full-fledged democracy. I guess it's just a question of how to get there. And President Obama is saying, we've tried this for 50 years, and that is not working, so let's try a different approach. What about that nuanced argument?
Carol, I disagree that we want the same ends. And with regards to President Obama, I thought he was quite glib and facile at his State of the Union address. First of all, we have seen what happens in these transitions. We have seen China, Vietnam, and Burma. If that is success, then I don't want that for the people of Cuba. I've spent 10 years in Asia covering the region. These are corrupt communist dictatorships that are highly repressive. In fact, they have gone backwards. China initiated a reform process 30 years ago. It has perfected the model of economic opening while keeping the Communist Party in power. That's not what I want for the 11 million people of Cuba. Success for me is Poland, Eastern Europe, the Baltic countries. Those regimes fell, and the people there are free now politically and economically. So I would suggest to Ted Piccone that he's taking quite a risk with 11 million lives when he bets that this economic opening is going to lead anywhere but to a prolonged repression.
Well, back to you, Ted Piccone. It's not really that President Obama is rewarding Castro per se, but trying a different approach. But how do you respond to critics like Mike Gonzalez who say, you know, we've seen this movie before, whether vis-a-vis China, Vietnam, Burma, we're not really seeing much of a change internally?
Well, there are many examples on both sides of this argument where the emergence of economic freedom, social freedoms, and prosperity, including a growing middle class, are the key ingredients to leading toward democratic change. And so we have to keep that in mind. I would also emphasize that Cuba rests in a very different part of the world than China or Vietnam. We're in a democratic hemisphere, and next door to the largest and one of the most powerful and most successful democracies in the world, the United States. And we have a long history together as partners in the region for good and for bad. And I think this change in policy will now allow our other neighbors in the region to join us in supporting democratic change in Cuba. That is the hemispheric standard, and it's not the standard in Asia. It is here. And I think we have to give a little more credit to the American actors that will be involved from the United States and from Latin America in engaging Cuba across a whole set of fields of activity. It will take time. It's not going to happen overnight. I think the kind of approach of regime collapse is actually a much riskier approach than what we're now going to try. Regime collapse could lead to greater violence, refugee outflows, and people dying trying to leave the island. Is that really what we want for Cuba? No, I don't think so. I think we want a stable transition to more open, more free, democratic Cuba, and it's going to take time. But this is an opening that we should take advantage of.
And back to you, Mike Gonzalez. There's an interesting point that we need to talk about, and that's the role that domestic politics plays, that is U.S. domestic politics. Now, many analysts say that U.S.-Cuba policy, the embargo, the lack of normalization to date, is really a product of U.S. domestic politics, the electoral votes in the very important swing state of Florida. The Cuban-American community, especially the older generation, is very vocal. They are very much against, for the most part, this opening, and they have a great deal of influence on both Democrats and Republicans. And we know that Florida, as we can attest by many previous presidential elections, is a very key state. So whether one is a Democrat or a Republican, they generally listen to this cohort. So to what extent do you think the sanctions and the embargo have had as much to do with U.S. domestic politics than any attempt to really affect change in Cuba?
Well, first I'd like to ask Ted, what examples does he have of communist regimes where there has been an economic opening, that then there has been a political opening, and why can't Cuba follow the example of the Czech Republic? Cuba was a very advanced state in the 1950s. Now, let me answer your question, Carol, which is a very good one. I am a Cuban-American. I am an American. I have every right to speak and to address my congressman, to have an impact on policy. That right is conferred on me by the Constitution. I have a right of redress, and I do not understand why Cuban Americans would then be the only people who would not be allowed to speak their minds on Cuba, a country they actually know rather well.
The point is, I am endorsing what you say. I'm not refuting that. I'm saying that this community has, because of our American political system, a voice. Nobody mm-hmm. is denying that voice. I'm just saying that is that voice so loud and so influential on politicians that they are loath to oppose this voice and actually challenge U.S. policy toward Cuba by trying to change it as President Obama is doing now?
I just don't think it's been distortionist. I think it has been right because Cuban Americans are very well poised to educate America as to the true nature of the Cuban regime. We wouldn't ask the victims of Nazism and fascism not to have a distortionist impact on U.S. policy. It does have an impact. I don't have a problem with it.
And how about you, Ted Bicone? How do you see this as a more of a domestic political issue as it is a foreign policy issue?
I agree that the Cuban American community has had an outsized voice in this debate, and I have no problem with that. I mean, this is a community that has been divided from their homes, and there's been great pain and suffering in the process. And they've also been highly successful here in the United States, and that's a credit to them and to our system. But there are other points of view in the United States body politic. And I would note that within Congress, there is a lot of division on both sides of the aisle about how to go forward on this, including Republicans like Senator Flake, but also Senator Moran. Senator Corker has noted that it is an ineffective policy, the embargo. We should have an open mind and have open debates about it. And we haven't had that in the last many years. And it's time to have a more sophisticated approach that brings all American voices into the discussion. I would also note that within the human rights community on the island, there are different points of view about how the United States should act in this current situation. And so it's not a monolithic voice. Within the Cuban American community itself, as you noted earlier, there are different points of view. It's somewhat generational, with younger Cuban Americans wanting to be able to have direct engagement with their home country and being able to travel and support their families directly. And it's these kinds of issues that need to be not only debated, but actually processes of communication, engagement, and dialogue that will ultimately bring us to a better outcome for the United States and for Cuba.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Mike Gonzalez. He's senior fellow at the Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington. And Ted Bicone, from whom you just heard, he's senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. That's a think tank based here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. We're discussing the pros and cons of President Obama's decision to restore diplomatic relations with Cuba. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and connect with us on Facebook, or send an email to encounter@voanews.com. And here's a shout-out to a loyal listener, Gloria Akintola. Thanks for your support, Gloria. Well, back to you, Mike Gonzalez. And let's talk about this human rights, because this is really a point on which many agree the island is terribly remiss, the Castro brothers, and this is a point of a major contention. But we do note that Pope Francis, you know, probably one of the strongest advocates of human rights in the world and a democracy advocate, he saw fit to not only defend this change, but actually be a party to it. He helped to push, broker, you know, this policy shift. Why do you think he did that?
I'm not sure, and I'm not inside his mind, but I do know the people, the dissidents on the island who are against this. I have talked to them a lot. Antonio Rodriguez Antunes, his wife, Iris Aguiar, Rosa Maria Payá, Fariñas, they all use the word betrayed. They feel that Obama betrayed him. In the case of Fariñas, he said Obama had promised him to consult with the dissidents before changing the policy, and that did not take place. So the few Cubans who are courageous enough to speak up to defy the police state are pretty much in unison in saying that they feel betrayed by President Obama. The rest of Cuba, of course, cannot express their minds, or they're afraid to, because they'll end up in prison. With regards to the Pope, maybe he was given bad advice by Cardinal Ortega. I really have no idea. I'm a Catholic. I'm very hesitant to criticize the Pope.
Well, back to you, Ted Picone, over there at Brookings Institution. I know that you were actually in Havana when President Obama announced this policy change. I'd like your take on the role of Pope Francis, why you think he was involved and was pushing for this change, someone that we associate with human rights and dignity, and also your take on the dissidents. This is not a monolithic group. Just as Mike Gonzalez said, there are some who feel, quote, betrayed by this policy shift. There are the ladies in white who have expressed their opposition. Talk about the role of the Pope and the fact that many dissidents are not happy about this policy shift.
Well, starting with the Pope, I mean, I think as the first Latin American Pope, it was particularly important to him to play a role in bringing this longstanding conflict to some kind of better resolution. And I applaud his efforts. And as President Obama reminded us at the State of the Union, that this will be a process of many small steps. I think the other key actor in why the Pope is involved, because the Cuban Catholic Church has important role to play on the island, and the bishops there have come out strongly criticizing the current government, calling for greater freedom of expression and association. They have an expanding voice. They host different debates, magazines that criticize the current policies of the government. So they're an important actor in the broader Cuban civil society that will allow for safer, more open debate about what's going on in the country. So it's not just about Pope Francis. It's about the Catholic Church more generally on the island having a larger voice in the future of Cuba. In terms of how the dissidents feel, I've talked to them at various points in the last few years and know from those conversations that they feel that they have to be given proper rights to be heard in Cuba's future. And so, again, it comes down to what is the best way to help them. We should continue to provide support to them, and they have a key voice to play. But there are other sectors in Cuban society that also need to come to the table and have that discussion. We need to see more academics, more think tanks. Now we have new groups of private sector businesses. They need to get organized. Labor unions need to be able to organize. And I think ultimately it's the international community that has to hold the Cuban government accountable for the international human rights standards that they've adopted. And we need to have UN monitors on the ground. This was part of the agreement that Pope Francis guaranteed. Moving the embargo out of this key part of the story puts more pressure on the Cuban government to actually improve its human rights performance.
Well, back to you, Mike Gonzalez. Let's talk about the role of Congress, because President Obama alone, through executive order, cannot change the policy. The Congress does have to vote to lift the embargo. How do you see this debate playing out in Congress? Based on what Ted Picone just said, there are certainly divisions on both sides of the aisle. We have Democrats opposed, like Senator Menendez. We have Republicans in favor of the policy shift. So how do you think this is going to play out?
I very much doubt that this Congress is going to lift the embargo. Obviously, if the embargo were to be lifted, the American taxpayer would be put on the hawk for the trade that we would have with Cuba, because Ex-Im Bank would have to get in. Cuba is a very well-known deadbeat borrower, has defaulted on loans to everybody, including the fact that the Congress knows that the other sectors that are going to be brought to the table, now we have pushed the dissidents aside, we're going to bring the generals who own the economy. Raul Castro's son-in-law is the head of GAESA. Raul Castro's son also owns a big chunk. We're going to have a communist dynastic succession like North Korea, 90 miles from our border. So the people that we're bringing are these crime syndicate people who own the economy. So Congress is not going to go for that, I'm afraid. In fact, taking Cuba off the terrorist list is going to be a bit of a haul itself, because Cuba, for example, which was caught less than 2 years ago violating a U.N. ban on shipments of weapons to North Korea. There are two Russian spy ships there right now. Cuba obviously supports the FARC in Colombia. It's a very well-known hub. It sells intelligence in the black market. Even Khrushchev wrote in his memoirs that he was surprised by the pathological anti-Americanism of the Castro brothers and the regime.
Nonetheless, let me turn back to Ted Bacone to get your take on how this debate over the lifting of the embargo may play out in Congress, because how much can be done? I mean, certain things are being done as we speak to ease the relationship, to restore diplomatic relations. But the embargo is key, is it not? How important is it for full normalization to occur?
Well, I think the president did everything he could under his executive authority to liberalize engagement with the island. And let's see that play out over the next 2 years. I don't expect Congress to move anytime quickly. As I said before, there's very divided opinion about what to do next. If anything, there might be some small measures, but anything that would dramatically roll back the president's initiatives would probably draw a veto threat. So I think we're probably at a stalemate. There'll be lots of important debates underway, for example, around Americans' right to travel to Cuba. It will become easier for Americans, but it still has restrictions. And some members of Congress feel that there should be no restrictions on Americans' right to travel anywhere in the world. And so that is one point that we'll probably see. On the state sponsors of terrorism issue, I mean, I think the State Department's own reports, if you read them carefully over the last few years, demonstrate that the Cuban regime actually has been moving in a better direction on this front. This is not the era of the Cold War. They are not supporting armed revolutions. In fact, regarding the FARC in Colombia, they are hosting peace talks between the government of Colombia and the FARC, and those peace talks are proceeding in a pretty positive way. So I think Cuba is trying to, in some cases, become a more normal country. Now, on North Korea, I think there is an issue around the arms transfer that happened that got caught in Panama. And I think we should all be concerned that Cuba would have participated in that kind of activity. And the UN looked into it, and there have been sanctions imposed on both countries as a result. But I think this is not the North Korean regime. Cuba is its own unique kind of set of actors and systems. I think on the economic side, in terms of who controls the future of Cuba's economy, this is precisely why we need to support the private sector and small farmers and make sure that this economic activity that they are generating happens within a formal framework and not under the black market in illicit ways, but in ways that will allow for the rule of law and institution building in Cuba.
Well, Ted Bacone, just quickly a follow-up. What about that allegation by Mike Gonzalez that the generals are in control, that it's a criminal syndicate? Do you think, in fact, that that can be broken through the measures that are being implemented?
I think the only way we're going to see that change is, number one, by strengthening other parts of Cuban society. So through the new role that small businesses are playing, cooperatives, and the farmer system, which the U.S. regulations will now allow us to directly support those actors. This will allow for direct creation and support to this burgeoning entrepreneurial class in Cuba. And secondly, I think when Raul Castro steps down in 2018, there will be a transition to a younger leadership that I expect will be more technocratic. You might see military becoming more civilian in their approach to this, and the future of Cuba's economy is going to be more inserted into the international economy, the tourist economy, and they're going to need to raise their standards to international levels. And I don't think there's going to be much room for a military-dominant economy if their economy is going to succeed in the 21st century.
All right, Mike Gonzalez, as we conclude, looking ahead to after the Castro brothers are gone, they will be leaving the scene. There's a younger generation. both inside Cuba and inside Florida among the immigrant community that are looking for change, looking for an opening with the United States. Your thoughts with respect to the future after Castro's?
Just because a general takes off his uniform and puts on a tie doesn't mean anything. Ted Picot knows well that the trend of the last year has been the growth of military cities for the military and their children to live in. They're gated, by the way. They own the economy. They're in place to take over and have the succession. We have seen this before. It took place in China, Vietnam, and Burma, highly repressive societies. Aung San Suu Kyi is telling people privately that the deal with the military cut by Hillary Clinton has prolonged their government. So North Korea, like Cuba, are communist governments where the founder passed the leadership to a relative. They are both communist dynasties. Cuba was caught less than 2 years ago breaking UN security sanctions by sending shipments of arms to North Korea. Those are the facts.
And the last word to you, Ted Picot, do you see Cuba following potentially in the footsteps of Burma, whose internal political situation has not been as promising as we had thought? What about the future after the Castros, and can the changing demographics, whether within Cuba and in the Cuban-American community in the United States, help to prevent Cuba from having the same fate?
Well, I think there are many examples. Myanmar, Burma is still undergoing change. I think it's a little too early to declare success or failure. But as we've seen in other cases, Indonesia, Brazil, Peru, where there were negotiated transitions and the military stepped out of playing a dominant role and other forces came forward to civilianize politics and the economy, these are now thriving democratic countries that we partner with very well, and those societies are benefiting from that kind of freedom. And you would hope that the Cuban people ultimately will come to the conclusion that that is a much better path for their future and that they will get more engaged in both the economy and in politics and lead to some kind of negotiated transition that will open their country and lead to more democratic and prosperous society.
Well, we'll certainly be talking about the normalization of relations between the United States and Cuba in the many weeks and months ahead, the ups and downs of that process. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Mike Gonzalez, he's Senior Fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and Ted Picot, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rob McLean, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.